The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Jerry Lewis.
It is a singular pleasure for me to introduce today's guest speaker. He's been a hero of mine since boyhood. When I was in high school... That's the wrong line. When I was in high school, Martin and Lewis were the hottest comedy act around.
Did you hear we split up?
Yeah. My best friend and I decided if Martin and Lewis could do it, so could Katz and Carmen. We formed our own comedy act, and we were good, very, very good. Really, we would have turned professional except for our sinus problem. No one would sign us.
Okay, that's it.
Designed to make you look good. Seriously, we brought Jerry Lewis here for a special reason. As you know, the balanced budget amendment failed in Congress. Now Democrats and Republicans are arguing over, I'm still laughing at the last joke, are arguing over how to reduce the federal budget deficit. Well, I have a suggestion for them. Jerry Lewis has collected nearly $1 billion in box office receipts over the years. His most popular films include The Bellboy, Cinderella, and The Nutty Professor for Melanie. He also has raised $1.4 billion for his favorite charity, the Crusade Against Muscular Dystrophy. And he's done it all without increasing taxes. Read my lips, no tax increase. So my suggestion, why not give Jerry Lewis the floor of the Congress and let him conduct a telethon for just one session. He could wipe out the federal debt single-handedly. Born Joseph Levitch in 1926, he was the child of professional entertainers. At the age of 20, Jerry joined with Dino Crosetti, better known as Dean Martin, to form one of the most famous comedy teams of all time. After the team broke up in 1956, see, I got that in there. Mr. Lewis went on to establish his credentials as a singer. He's been called, quote, the last of the classic vaudevillians, unquote. Matter of fact, he's even more popular abroad, particularly in France, than he is in this country. He's been named best director in that country three times. He's been inducted into the Legion of Honor. He's been made a commander in the Order of Arts and Letters. The French Minister of Culture called him a child's friend and a model for adults. Mr. Lewis, excuse me, is no stranger to Washington. He was a member of President John F. Kennedy's Fun Circle. He's been honored by the Senate for his crusade against muscular dystrophy. In 1985, the Defense Department awarded him the Medal for Distinguished Public Service. Mr. Lewis has five sons and several grandchildren. He and his wife, Sam, have a young daughter, Danielle. Jerry's most recent movie, Funny Bones, was released by Disney in March. He's now playing Satan in the Broadway revival of Damn Yankees, a role that the New York Times said makes him, quote, legitimate at last, unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, we've heard from Democrats, we've heard from Republicans. They've all reported their views on the first 100 days of the new Congress. Now let's hear a different perspective from our guest, Jerry Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. That was a lovely introduction, Bud. I thought I was at my own funeral. When I was first contacted by the National Press Club, which was about a year or so ago, I wasn't available to come here, and I had written to the individual that had written to me stating that the moment I can make it, I would be truly honored to be present at the National Press Club. Now, before I get into the why of that, when they knew I was coming today, the press department for the National Press Club called and said, "What is your title of your speech?" And I said, "My life as a Viking." I didn't know I needed a goddamn title to come here and talk. But in spite of what Bud said, I need for you to know that I do not get into politics. I do comedy already. I have a strong point of view. I'm a serious-minded man. I do some of the most ridiculous, absurd, physical comic things that have ever been seen by the human condition. While I do have a point of view, I have strong beliefs. I think politics belong where they belong. I think humor should be more a part of politics. Indeed, we'd be able to swallow some of it much more easily. I truly believe that Newt Gingrich, just look at his initials. Now, only because I think public broadcasting is a magical, important communication in this country today. I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm proof positive in looking at the excellence of this child's brain and watching the beauty of her formative years. She speaks in 3 languages, though not totally. She does her ABCs in French, Hebrew, and English. She got that from public broadcasting. Her understanding of animals, the kingdom, the world, she got from Nova. She got an awful lot from her mother and father. But any chance I get to put public broadcasting where it belongs, as a priority, in the foreground of our lives, I do that. That's the end of the commercial. I will go forward now. If you could raise the volume a little bit, I won't have to get quite as close to the microphone. I'd appreciate that. Alec? Electrician, do you mind if I just get... Well, it's not as bad as yours, Bud. An interesting commentary in that when I was asked to do Damn Yankees, I had a very, very strong, difficult time wrestling with making that decision, primarily because I had never been on Broadway, and I felt that if I was going to do Broadway, it would have to be absolutely primo. The show is that. The show is a spectacular show, and anyone fortunate enough to be placed in that show is very, very lucky. But I felt that I was 69 years old, 8 shows a week, and I had just come back from London, and I did a film called Funny Bones where the director wanted very much for me to put on weight so that I would look more mature and elderly and so on. I complied happily. I had steak and eggs for breakfast and Carling's brew at 10 in the morning, and then at lunch we'd have a lager, and then we would have wonderful dinners with a vodka or two, and then a fine wine along with dinner. And I put on about 34 pounds, and I was up to 200 pounds. Now when Damn Yankee said, "We would like you to do this," I said, "There's no chance in hell I'm ever going to be the devil at 200 pounds. I said, "I will consider it if you will allow me 3 months to lose the weight, learn the book, learn the songs, come to New York prepared and ready." For the first time in the history of Broadway, the producers went to the unions who gave them permission to shut the show down while I worked on the treadmill. I stayed under 800 calories a day. I worked the treadmill 5 miles every morning, 5 miles every evening. I played with my daughter, which was equal to the 10 miles on the treadmill. And I had to get a focus, probably for the first time in my life. I needed a focus of infinite care within my own brain, which included making a total, complete turnaround with the press, to deal with them differently, to recognize that they were part of this pattern that I was getting into. I was going to sell the show. I was going to be the best guest on any television show, the best one-on-one with reporters. I turned around my whole point of view, which was all part of the focus. I lost the weight. I'm happy to proclaim I'm 166 pounds. I'm having the best time. I did 127 one-on-ones in the last 12 weeks. I did 63 electronic press. I'm doing Phil Donahue tomorrow morning for 2 hours. I'm doing 2 hours of A&E, and they're doing a two-hour biography that I did with Dateline, and I'm still going. The point I'm making here is now the National Press Club invites me to come there. Well, it's the first time I could acknowledge that invitation and come happily, proudly, and with a full heart. I cannot remember feeling quite this good about having anything to do with the press in a long, long time. And the conversion is a wonderful one because it's serving me so well. I feel so good about it. I feel so good about the focus that I have been on. Now I walk out on that stage, and it's like the parting of the Red Sea. These audiences are they're either thrilled that I'm making it, or they're delighted that there isn't an ICU waiting for me, or that I'm just getting through with the show. But whatever the hell it is, they stand up every show and they're screaming and carrying on like the goddamn Beatles were out there. And I'm getting all of the benefits of this. The only downtime for me is Monday when we don't have a damn show. My daughter recognizes what's happening with me. She sees that I'm having the time of my life. And now I find that I've become a role model for men who are considering retiring at 55. Why? An atrophy? Look at what I'm doing. I'm going to be on the national tour for my 70th birthday. We'll be in Baltimore on my 70th birthday. Then we finish the national tour after a year of Damn Yankees, and we do the film for Warner Brothers, which takes us to June of 97. Then in July of 97, we open it in London for a year, which takes us to June of 98. We go to Paris from July 98 till the first month of 99, and then go to Berlin for the balance of the year. So I'm booked and having the time of my life. I got on a train today on my day off to come to the National Press Club. If you had told me that 10 years ago, I'd have shot you. It's incredible. But I came because I wanted this platform. I wanted to be able to say to the press, I need you as badly as you need me. And working together is a joy. Now I'm getting letters from the interviewers. There's a wonderful writer that writes for Interview Magazine in New York. He sent me flowers to my dressing room with a lovely card for the one-on-one we did for 2 hours. Then I called him. His name's Graham Fuller. I called him. I said, Graham, you don't understand. It was me that had all the fun. It was wonderful for me to be this good about what I was doing. He said, yeah, I noticed that the angry man wasn't there anymore. I said, well, I had reasons for that. I'll give you a case in point. A reporter in Chicago, some years ago, went to see a film that was my baby. I wrote it, produced it, acted in it, and went through labor pains with it. Prior to its opening, I sent out what I thought was Tiffany-like packages of information about the film, stills of the film. The film was called Which Way to the Front. It was a great satire on the Hitler years in Germany. And it was great comedy. And this newspaper man reviewed the film in Chicago and reviewed a scene that I had cut out after we sent this material out. I did a preview after I sent all the publicity packets out. And at the preview, I was concerned with that sequence. It really wasn't working. I deleted the 8-minute sequence. He reviewed it from the information that was in the folder. He never saw the film. He broke my heart because I felt that was dirty and unfair and not really professional. So when you talk about an angry man, I'm carrying some anger from about 100 of those. But then you get the joy of knowing that you shake hands and you have a friendship with Jack Anderson and the likes of those kinds of men. I'm proud to stand here and say to you that Edward R. Murrow and I had a meaningful relationship as friends. Walter Cronkite, I always wish was my father. So for the bad guys in your racket, we got some bad guys in our racket, but isn't it nice to find out that 98% are terrific and that the 2% are interesting to talk about, but they're meaningless? I sound like Norman Vincent Peale all of a sudden. Anyhow, the 8 grueling shows are terrific. What people don't remember is that when Dean and I played the Paramount Theater, we did 56 shows a week. We played there for 2 weeks. It was 112 shows. They ran an hour and 10 minutes each show. We then went to the Chicago Theater and performed 9 a day, which is 63 shows. In the 3 weeks, we performed 175 shows in 21 days. Now I'm at the press conference at Sardi's, and the reporter yells, "How are you going to handle a grueling 8 shows a week?" I said, "I did 175 shows in 21 days. He said, "But you were 20 years old. I said, "So I'm 69. I'm only doing 8. That works for me. I just hope you get a chance to see the show, because it's a marvelous company. And I've been playing the devil for 64 years. I had my first tux on at the age of 5, performed with my mom and dad. I was as mischievous then as I am now. But this role was written with this devilish character. And when I went to see it last October to see if I wanted to go with it, I was amazed that I hadn't remembered. I've been playing this character 64 years. It's perfect. Now I get people coming backstage saying, "When did they write that show for you?" Which is not the case, of course, but it's wonderful. Oh, I have to tell you this. There's another very important thing here. Coming here at this time of the year, I really want you to know how important it was to me. This is the High Holy Holidays, in case you're interested. And in my faith, the High Holy Holidays, nothing moves. Everything stands still in the High Holy Holidays. So I have to tell you this incident. In the High Holy Holidays in the Jewish faith, people stay home and they cook and they're with family. They don't travel, they don't spend money, they don't do anything. Well, I knew this Jewish rabbi. What other kind of rabbi? Well, I knew this rabbi. He loved to play golf so much. It was better than breathing for him. And it's the High Holy Holidays. And this rabbi sneaks out to the country club. Tees up the ball, and it's a 5-par hole. Tees up his ball, and he's going to play golf. St. Peter is watching this. St. Peter says, "God, could you come here for a second?" God walked over, and St. Peter said, "Take a look." God looked and said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of everything. When you tell it, you use yours. When I tell it..." So St. Peter said, "God, this is unconscionable. A man of the cloth about to play golf on the High Holy Holidays?" God said, "Watch, in a second, you'll see this." The rabbi hits this ball on this 5-par, 525 yards. The ball flies 525 yards, lands on the green, and it rolls into the cup. St. Peter looks at God and said, "God, what kind of punishment is that?" God said, "Who's he going to tell?" You know, for years we've been doing Polish jokes, and people forget that it started way before that. It started in the 1900s. I'm sharing information with you that I learned from my dad. There were Irish jokes. They were the jokes. The Italian jokes. They were the jokes. Way before the Polak jokes. The black jokes. Lutheran jokes. Christian jokes. Confessional jokes. Incredible how the wheel turns. I don't know who's getting it next, but Polacks are in now, as you know. And the interesting thing is that if we didn't have humor to diffuse the lives we lead in the world we're functioning in, we'd be in far greater trouble than we are. Humor diffuses the pressure. People cannot be in pain while laughing. We have found that pain will cease and desist while a good laugh is happening in the body. That's, of course, why the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences don't even have a category for comedy, but I won't get into that now. So if you can diffuse the pain and pressure of everyday's life with humor, it's so marvelous. And people have to stop being, how can I use this expression and still be diplomatic? People have to stop being so tight about being offended. A Polack joke is probably laughed at more by the Polack than anyone else. The Jew thought it was a wonderful joke, if the humor was there. And we do things now in our business. There are, of course, 9,000 stand-ups in our country today, 6,000 of whom should sit down, but we do have some wonderful young performers. We've got performers that are taking some of the ethnic humor and devising wonderful comic tones with it and doing visual things. I give you Robin Williams as a perfect example. The brilliance of Robin Williams and everything he does touches on ethnic humor, touches on everything. But he's fast enough that you don't really see it. He's so brilliant with his visual comic ability that you don't see exactly where all of his nonsense is coming from. Billy Crystal is a little smoother about it. Steve Martin's a little smoother about it. Whoopi Goldberg is very aggressive about it. But we've got great talents out there. What I am displeased with is the young comic that stands up in a small room and he now prepares cerebral combat. He's going to challenge this audience to hear what he has to say. Well, you don't say to your friends, let's go and hear this comedian. You usually say, let's go see him. Well, what are you going to go see? Audio? You should be seeing visual. So I say to the young comics, move. Move your body. You can tell the rabbi joke by moving all over the country club. Just make it visual. So they listen to me because I'm the elder statesman now. And they're, what are you choking about? I am. No. You have to be delighted about it. I learned that age really resents the fact that you're delighted about it. When you're delighted about it, for some reason, age looks at you and says, oh, Christ, I'm going to get someone else. It's wonderful to challenge it and get up every day and say, the minute I was 69, I'm telling everybody I'm going to be 70. It's wonderful. And my wife says, why are you rushing it? I said, I can't rush the calendar, but I can talk about it. It's a wonderful thing to be able to, I made 70? Jesus, with the way people drive today? You know what I had in mind? Oh, I have to tell you, Shirley MacLaine came to see the show, and she had a wonderful time. She comes backstage, and she told me that I'm 526 years old, and I worked with Da Vinci for 10 years, then we broke up. An idea that I had. I want to open a franchise of eulogy stores where you can walk in off the street and for $20 they'll read you all the wonderful things they're going to say about you after you croak. Wouldn't that be a marvelous chain of eulogy stores? I love that. Okay. I've talked at 1,700 universities around the world in the last 25 years. 100 different cinema classes and maybe 5,000 acting, cinema, and film classes around the world. And it's always interesting to me when we do open forum, primarily I always say to the group that I'm speaking to that I'm not standing there as a qualified anything. I'm there sharing my life and all the things that I've experienced, and we get into sessions and it's incredible how young people want to pull from you. And their curiosity is so incredible. At sometimes you do 4 hours, you don't know where 4 hours went. And it's just back and forth, question and answer. And I had a menu. And I would read to the students, now here's where we can go. Film, directors, state-of-the-art sound, state-of-the-art video, Broadway, France, the economy, the media, humanities, culture, world humor, medicine, travel, business, Judge Ito, unions, Marsha Clark's hair, the elderly, poverty in America, communications, giving, community service, parenting. When you give a group that kind of a menu to choose from, to talk about, and then a card comes up and it reads, "Did you ever fool around with Marilyn Monroe?" It's a little depressing, but it's interesting because there's a curiosity there. So you answer it to the best of your ability and you hopefully get out with your skin still intact. But I watched the National Press Club on C-SPAN whenever I could, when I was home, particularly it's on at 10 o'clock in Las Vegas. And I love watching it, yet I'm intrigued by the cards that the president of the club will read to the guests and getting comments from the guests from the cards. I'm waiting for that. That's my most favorite time. Can we do that, Bud?
Yes.
I can't wait. Because it's really intriguing to me at what comes up. And the interesting thing is you don't know what it's going to be. Therefore, it's an exercise. See what you're going to come up with, what your answers are. Are you credible? Is it honest? Are you going to deal in theatrics? Are they expecting you to be a buffoon? Do they truly want to know that? Is it important? Is it worthwhile? Is it meaningful? And all of that stuff goes through your mind when you do that. How do you do it? How do you do it, Bud?
Well,
I've never seen you do it.
You sort of step up here like this.
Yes.
You
oh,
hold
okay.
this card there. It's blank.
In other words, I'm working with a guy again.
That's
is that
right.
it?
I can't sing.
Okay.
Mr. Lewis, you have brought so much laughter and enjoyment to myself and others. What can we do to bring movies and TV back to clean, nonviolent entertainment?
Well, I don't think that it's going to take a committee of people to change the structure of a film that will do $267 million. How do I say to that producer, that's violent, it's not good for our children? He's just bought a home in San Carbo, Bobby Lucas, whatever you call that. He's very, very happy with his roles, and he's certainly not going to change his lifestyle. He's going to listen to me say to him, this is not good for the children of America. But you have to remember that there are films out there, like Free Willy. There's a producer there that cares about what your children think, for that matter, what the children's family thinks. There are producers that make good work. There are people that do Nova on PBS. We've got great filmmakers that are doing great work. This is a generalization. What can we do about nonviolent and family-like entertainment? We've got a lot of it. We're talking about maybe the 7 or 10% of the product that isn't what we really think it should be. But on the whole, and I may sound offensive, but I love my industry, on the whole, I think we do some good work. You cannot forget the Steven Spielbergs of the world. You cannot forget Schindler's List. If we forgot it, it would have been a waste. That's quality, and our children will learn from that. And there's a lot more I could name that are important works done by important producers. Who will be, ultimately, who will be the messenger to the other producers ultimately one day when they see their product's not going to move, they're going to change? That's bound to happen because I have seen it in all of the years that I've been performing. The quality comes to the top, and the credibility is like cream in a bottle of milk. It always comes to the top. So I have a great faith and trust in our system. Not government necessarily, but our system.
Why do you think the French have an even greater appreciation of your talent and genius than the people of your own country?
Well, I think there's a misnomer there. I think that the people of my country have given me tremendous longevity. They've been there for me every moment of my entire life. This has been a misnomer in that the French critics have hailed my work as exceptional, and I'm proud of that. But the truth is that Spain, Italy, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Japan, and Australia are far greater Jerry Lewis fans than the French. But the French have gotten all the publicity because Americans are down on the French so often. And they love this combination. They like this pratfall Jewish comedian. Well, what does that tell you? But that's okay. That's okay. There's politics in everything. The truth is that the American people have given me 64 years of their love and affection, and I've given it back. And this is where I live. Number one is here. France can be too. Go ahead, Bud.
From your experience, can you assess the value to the arts community of the National Endowment for the Arts?
Can I assess the value?
Yeah, to the arts community in general of the National Endowment for the Arts.
In other words, do I think we should be spending that money?
Yes.
Uh-huh, of course.
Is it worth it?
Of course it's worth it. It's part of culture. If we're going to stop that, let's stop parents teaching children manners. It may not save us any money, but it's a procedure that we could stop. Let's stop teaching our children please and thank you. It's the same thing. Or caring for one another, or dialing 911 when you see a man having heart failure. Do we not make that call because it might be a toll call? How do you stop the endowment of the arts for the youth of this country? Mr. Kennedy said it better than anybody. Our children, that's our greatest natural resource. And if we're doing it for a ballet company that happens to be in Des Moines and they need some revenue, I would maybe get into a discussion about how to deal with that. But generically, it's a very tough call. You can't generalize. I don't think you can do that. But you should recognize that government that has the answers needs a little sensitivity, they need a sense of humor, and they need to face the fact that we're talking about human beings here. They become numbers on a bill that goes through the Senate. And they forget that what's behind that are human beings that are going to bring to our children a greater future. We should examine that from that point of view. Go ahead. I'm going to get in trouble any minute now.
Well, there's a bunch of questions about your breakup with Dean Martin.
Well, why don't we talk about Lindbergh landing in Paris? It's the same thing.
Can you finally reveal what caused it, the breakup?
He was too tall.
But you wore slim heels.
Right. But
I remember
that's a question I want to save. Do you remember what I told you about before, the Marilyn Monroe question? Here it is. That's it. Okay.
I won't even ask those. You ask them.
No, I will not. No, I won't. I won't reply to
you,
that.
No Marilyn Monroe question.
No Marilyn Monroe jokes. Go ahead. Come on, bud. You're on.
You know, you're supposed to answer questions. Give me a little time.
Well, you're editing. He's picking the ones that he wants to know.
What were your thoughts and feelings when you just walked on stage for the first night of Damn Yankees? This is a fan of yours for many years, Sandy.
The only way I can answer that is to tell you that it was a rush and an adrenaline that I thought was that night. I had it again yesterday at the matinee. After my 57th performance, the rush and the adrenaline is the same. If you come to see the show 2 weeks from now, the rush is going to be the same. It was something my dad had told me about that he couldn't expound on. I told someone at the reception earlier that I had played the Palladium, and I asked my dad and my mom to come to England with me to see me play the Palladium. And they were there that first night when I appeared for Her Majesty the Queen. And unlike ever happening in the royal family, after I did 2.5 hours by myself on stage, Her Majesty stood and applauded, as did the audience. And I went back to my dressing room and I said to my dad, "Well, it doesn't get better than that." He said, "It does if you play Broadway." And opening night of Damn Yankees, I knew what he meant. And I heard in my soul his voice, and he said, "Now you got it." That's the only way I can explain it.
What was it like working with Ingmar Bergman in The Seventh Seal?
Did Ingmar Bergman make a film, The Seventh Seal?
I don't know.
I wasn't in it.
I wasn't doing it either.
I think I remember my body of work. I was not in the goddamn Seven Seal.
What was it like not being in the Seven Seal?
What was it like not being in it? A joy to behold.
Tell us what you think about television coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial.
I think that two people are dead and they're ignored and they don't have a show. I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong and I think it's tasteless. I think it's money-making, it's money-grubbing. I'm ashamed of the media that's doing it. I think I'm doubly ashamed of those that watch it.
As Satan in Damn Yankees, do you think any of today's major politicians have made a deal with the devil?
If they did, they'd be better.
You mentioned that. You need longer answers.
Hey, I can do an hour in the next 5 minutes, I promise you.
You mentioned your problems with the press. When did they start and why did they start?
Well, it's a generalization. And when I mention my problems with the press, I shouldn't be generic about that either. It was the 2% or the 4% or the 6% that didn't do their homework and or they weren't true journalists. If you were asked something about a film and or your lifestyle and you answer them, they're not only holding a tape recorder, but they're also making notes, and then you're misquoted. You know you're dealing with a non-professional. Now, conversely, Edward R. Murrow never needed notes. He just talked to you. And he then transmitted the information impeccably. So I make very, very clear, I've never been generically opposed. I've just been opposed to those that don't belong in the racket. I think that I am as disturbed, not because someone in the press doesn't belong in it, but I'm more disturbed at the fact that there's a qualified individual that can't get a job. So they're doing a double whammy. They're not good at what they're doing, and they're hurting people. Same thing in our business. I want credible people doing the work that they should be doing.
Whatever happened to Jerry's Orphans? They got a lot of press a couple of years ago, but not much recently. Have you and they reached some kind of quiet rapprochement? Have they lost steam? What?
I haven't the faintest idea where they are. I didn't know they were here when they were. I have no idea where they've gone. And that's of no consequence. Nothing will stop what I need to do that I work all year long to prepare for Labor Day. No splinter group will stop me. Nothing can stop me other than the beat of my heart. And that won't even stop me.
You mentioned your online interviews. Do you use a computer and are you personally online?
No, I don't use a computer. I am who I am with. I wrote a piece once for the American Medical Association, asked the Writers Guild very often to write pieces for their JAMA. And some years back, I wrote a piece called I Am Who I'm With, and it was very interesting in rereading it. I found so much about myself, as you all do when you write something. And I found that when I'm with someone who is forthright, I am equally as forthright. When I'm someone who has great credentials, I feel like I do too. If I'm with someone who I believe doesn't really want to be there, they lose me. If I think that they're not qualified, I feel unqualified. If they're warm, I'm equally as warm. If they're sensitive, I'm sensitive. If they're cold, I can be chilling. If they're hostile, I can be hostile. I usually wait to see who I'm with before I allow my personality to show its face. And most all people do that. Did you ever say good morning to somebody that said, get the hell out of the way? Never. Jesus, I didn't know how smart I was.
Leaving myself aside.
Of course.
Okay. Who's the funniest man you've ever known?
Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin was and will always be the forerunner and the magician of great, great humor. He was a great, great musician. He was a brilliant ballet dancer. He was an impeccable mime. He was an extraordinary talent. He was a brilliant man. And he taught most of us not what to do, but what we shouldn't do. He was impeccable.
Well, you've often been called the heir to Charlie Chaplin's mantle.
I know what I'm saying.
Who do you see as your heirs?
I think anybody that does comedy and cares about it and cares what it does. For example, there's a man amongst you today that came up to me and said, Jerry, I want to shake your hand and thank you because when I was a small boy, my life as a young man was traumatized. He didn't go into the why of that, but he said, because of your films, I lived through that period, and I thank you for that. Well, anyone who does what I do and recognizes that you can have that kind of influence on a human being, the heirs to what I do are people who care deeply about what they do and recognize their responsibility. That's who I would like to have as heirs, as it were.
Looking further into the future, how do we fill the proposed 500 new TV channels that may be coming? Is a Hallmark Hall of Fame in our future?
Well, if today's television broadcasting and programming is any indication of how we're going to fill the 500 new television channels, if we're talking about high-definition television and the new support that that's going to need and the technology it's going to bring, I think we're going to need product, but I could tell you facetiously that all we need is 7 or 8 murders during the course of a year and we'll fill 500 channels. Facetiously, of course.
Why do you call your 3-year-old daughter, Danielle, your miracle child?
Well, we don't have the time for me to tell you about my daughter. She's the air in my lungs, and she's what daddies have with little girls. I had a lot of sons, and I was always told during those years, wait till you have a girl. And I'd say, you can't love anything more than you love your sons, no? Watch. She's a miracle baby because she knows exactly what's happening. She's brilliant. And she's my daughter. And she looks at my film or she looks at something that I'm doing on television and she puts her arms around my neck and she says, I like this daddy better. That daddy is silly. I like this daddy better.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.